KaiserNetwork.org.
Good day, I'm Jill Braden-Balderas with KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks for tuning in to Ask the Experts, our regular live web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with top experts. To get involved in today's show as we turn our attention to mental health care in the United States, email your questions to us at ask@KaiserNetwork.org. That's ask@KaiserNetwork.org. Or you can call 1-888-524-7378. That's 1-888-KAISER-8. A significant number of people suffering from mental disorders in the U.S. do not receive the treatment they need. So what are some of the stumbling blocks people face? How are successful programs effectively improving access and delivery of care? And is parity in mental health insurance coverage a realistic and attainable goal? Here in our studio to help us sort through these questions and more, we're joined by Catherine Power, Director of the Center for Mental Health Services at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, Mike Fitzpatrick, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Richard Frank, a professor with Harvard Medical School's Department of Healthcare Policy. Thanks so much to all three of you for joining us today. Catherine, I'd like to start with you. Three major reports in the last decade, the 1999 Surgeon General's Report on Mental Health, the President Bush's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health in 2003, and the IOM report released just last fall, have all concluded that there's still a lot of work to be done in the arena of mental health care here in the United States. Mm-hmm. What is your assessment of the situation with mental health care, and what is your office's charge to help improve it?
I think the overall assessment for mental health care in America is that it is improving. I think those three reports specifically helped focus the attention of America and helped focus the attention of every individual in America on the fact that mental health care had not been perceived, nor accessed, nor treated in the same way that other physical health care disorders had been treated. And I think specifically, the Surgeon General's report really based the scientific research evidence on the table. And I think the President's New Freedom Commission report really talked about what the state of care looked like and whether or not the outcomes for people with mental illnesses were improving. And then the IOM report really acknowledged the fact that if you don't take care of behavioral health needs of individuals at work, that is, care about their mental health and substance abuse disorders, then in fact you're really not taking care of them as employees and in fact making sure that they're productive people. So I thought those three reports really focused on the fact that for many, many years, individuals with mental illnesses have not been treated the same way as individuals with other disorders. And in that respect, really brought to bear, I think, the kind of attention that is necessary and will continue. So my sense is that the status of mental health care in America is improving based on the fact that we finally have a focus on specifically saying, how do we need to meet the needs of individuals with mental illnesses? And we're working on that. The role of my office at the Center for Mental Health Services at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is basically to help facilitate that transformation that was called for. And I think transformation was really called for in all three of those reports. What are we going to do, and how are we going to improve the lives of people with mental illnesses? And my role at the Center for Mental Health Services is to make sure that individuals and communities and states and all of the agencies that should be involved in providing appropriate care are involved. And we're very excited about that work.
And we'll definitely get more into the work that you're doing there. I want to turn it over to Mike Fitzgerald. Let's talk a little bit about your organization's report card that came out earlier in the year. Can you talk about what were the grades, the overall grades for the United States and maybe some specific states, and then also what the baseline was that you used in order to give states these grades?
What we looked at, and really using the vision that came from the New Freedom Commission, and the Surgeon General's report, and to some extent the Institute of Medicine's report, to look at the infrastructure that was available in the state and what the how much money, how much time, how much planning, what the vision was over time in each individual state and the District of Columbia, what kind of political will had there been, and really what kind of investment over the last 16 years in sort of building a system of care that would be accessible to people, that if you went on to a mental health authority's website or called their 800 number, there would be easily accessible information. We really provided really a consumer reports while at the same time grading states. America got a D, 8 states got Fs, 18 states got Ds, But even in those states that arguably did very poorly, we saw bright lights. We purposely looked in every state to try to point out the best practices, because there are best practices out there. What you have is real inconsistency in planning and follow through over time, and also a recognition that you need to look very carefully on each dollar spent to make sure that it's spent on services that we call evidence based, that your funding supported employment, supported housing, and assertive treatment programs. Integrated treatment for substance abuse and mental illness, and then if you put together, and we came up with 39 criteria that we graded each state on. It was a blinded rating, and we intend to come back. We intend to come back in 3 years and regrade the states. But again, there is promise out there. I think there's hope, and we got feedback from virtually every state, and even the states that failed. Talking about next steps. And so we're optimistic. And I think when we come back in 3 years, we'll begin to see change, partially driven by the transformation activities from the New Freedom Commission, but also a sense of the need for communities to take responsibility for mental illness and begin to look at best practices and begin to follow through and do what's right to build an effective system of care.
So we've heard a little bit about the state of mental health care in the United States and a little bit about what's needed to move forward. Richard Frank, can you tell us, kind of give us a history of mental health care in the United States and, you know, the in terms of treatment and who pays for treatment and just basically to kind of let us know how we've gotten to where we are today. Yeah, exactly, briefly.
Well, actually, if you were to go back 55 years, before President Kennedy's now famous message about mental health, the mental health system is almost unrecognizable then looking at it today. Almost all the money we spent was spent on custodial treatment in state mental hospitals. The chances of getting something that would do more good than harm were modest. And it was at that time we were just starting the first wave of major clinical breakthroughs that are kind of recognizable today as modern mental health. And really the turning points were a combination of the development of some of the new technologies, but also and that led to therapeutic optimism. A set of breakthroughs on the pharmacology front, on the psychosocial front, each one of those suddenly became recognized as things that could do some good. And that was really developed in the 50s and then the early 60s, which then was sort of coupled with the passage of Medicare, Medicaid, and the Community Mental Health Centers Act, which dramatically shifted, one, the amount of money available to treat mental illnesses, but two, the location of where that treatment could take place. Now consumers would be able to get treatment in the community. They had a source of payment. There was encouragement for people being treated in the least restrictive settings close to their home. And then accompanying all of that were a bunch of legal cases that established various rights for patients or as we often call them today, consumers. And that really opened up the world to the development of what is today the modern mental health system. And that's characterized by relatively small percentages of people and relatively small percentages of money now spent in hospitals compared to 50 years ago. A much greater chance of getting evidence-based treatment today than even 25 years ago. More money to support people with mental disorders, both in the community and in treatment. But there have been some downsides, and those are related to the increasing presence of people with mental illnesses in prisons and the higher rates of homelessness in this country.
I'd like to just add, if I could, to the comments that one of the things that I think is important at this juncture in time is that we have really embraced a concept of recovery. And I think that both Richard and Michael probably see that. that we've reached a point in the evolution of mental health care where the consumer has really defined now what is needed for a life rather than someone else telling the consumer what is needed for a life. And the whole commission report in this period discovered that what was different from the President Carter Commission report and the President Bush Commission report was that finally we started to talk about recovery and the idea of recovery so that individuals with these very serious illnesses could in fact live in the community, could in fact with appropriate supports move on and manage their illness in a way that they had never been thought of before. And I think that's pretty significant.
You know, we always say the treatment works if you can get it. And that's a challenge, I think, for us in America, because much of the change that, Richard's describing took place individually in states very inconsistently. And so it's again, you have places where you can find treatment, and the system of care hangs together well, and then places where it's incomprehensible.
In terms of the payment for treatment, Richard, can you just kind of give us a little bit of the background on what's the breakdown in terms of private insurance versus states paying for treatment?
Well, right now, about 63-65% of the money that we spend flows through government, either state or federal or local. Medicaid is the largest single payer, which is about 27% of all mental health spending comes through Medicaid. Private insurance is about on equal footing as direct state spending, which is around 23%. And then you have smaller programs like Medicare, which pays for about 7%. So really, Medicaid, private insurance, and state governments are really the three heavy hitters in this area.
And in terms of what it would cost to treat a patient or consumer of these services, can you kind of give us the range of, say, what it would cost to treat someone for a mild depression versus someone who has bipolar?
Well, let's put it this way. Evidence-based treatment for depression, sort of getting the right stuff at the right time for sort of the acute and then the continuation phase, the estimates range in the sort of anywhere from $700 to $1,500 roughly for if there is no hospitalization involved, which is the vast majority. And that really is evidence that can pay for evidence-based treatment. So it's actually a very good deal, given how effective it is. Treatment for schizophrenia is much more expensive, and it involves much more complexity. And the numbers that we see from Medicaid suggest that for a person with schizophrenia over a one-year period, it costs on the order of $9,000 to $11,000 per year.
Did you want to?
I was going to mention that when I ran a state system in the state of Rhode Island, we were, of course, asked by the governor and the legislature to do comparison cost in terms of community cost versus institutional cost. And no matter what the range of the illness was, it's very clear that community-based care is much more cost-effective, which is why you've seen a transition from the institutional cost to the community-based cost. And actually, it ends up being about one-fifth the cost to support people in the communities, no matter how serious the illness might be, even if they have to go in and out of acute hospitalizations, than to keep people in institutions. So the cost factor is really quite significant when you think about the array of services that you need to support people in the community. The difficulty here is getting the payer to accept the kinds of services and practices that are necessary to keep people in the community. And that really is the dilemma, I think, for a lot of the payers. Can they pay and do they see the kind of services and supports that are required to keep people in the community as bona fide reimbursable services?
And they really range from assertive treatment teams to sort of peer-based services, to supported housing, to supported employment. And so there's a whole range of services that are available in bits and pieces here and there that need to be built as a continuum that are easily accessible, that people can pay, understand how you pay for them. And again, that's when you begin to see the vision sort of breakdown. And the IOM report talks about it eloquently, the breakdown between promise and practice. How many years does it take to get innovation sort of into the field? And I think that's all of our challenge.
Well, I know both of you probably have great examples of innovation in the field.
Yes.
So, Catherine Power, if I could start with you. If you could tell us a little bit about the state planning branch that you work with and some of the successful programs that they have been able to foster in states?
Well, across the Center for Mental Health Services, including the state planning group, we have a number of service programs and grant programs that states are able to use. Basically, we see states and the host of communities that comprise a state as the centers of gravity for transformation. And our task really is to support the states and facilitate our supporting the states to bring transformation practices into play. Michael talked about how do you bring those to scale. You can have a pocket of excellence in a particular community. How do you bring that into a region or into a full state? And that really means you really have to focus on appropriate planning, changes in the infrastructure, and getting effective practices into the hands of the providers. That's really what we're doing in our agency. We're trying to make sure that the block grant that is done within the state planning grant resources are used, that the division that supports planning supports states getting together and having all of the right players at the table to have the planning discussion. The Mental Health State Incentive Grant Program, which is specifically designed to give states money for transformation activities, has just started this past year. That is the federal government's attempt to support, in the seven states that were awarded those grants, the change management that's necessary to transform your system. So we're actually putting money in states that they can use to help step back, get the players at the table, work through organization and financing issues, establish evidence-based practices, do appropriate workforce development so that you can show that you've improved outcomes for people. Very specific, very targeted, and we're hoping, as Michael said, in 3 years, that those investments will have paid off, that we will, in fact, begin to see that from those states, as well as other states that are doing transformation without additional money, that there will be improvement in the lives of people. So every part of the agency at the Center for Mental Health Services, the state planning group, the block grant staff, all of the folks who work on the homelessness program, all of the folks who work on suicide prevention, all of the folks who work on disaster readiness, we're trying to make sure that from our standpoint at the federal level, we're promoting transformation across all of our grants and programs.
Now, Michael, you had talked about the bright lights, some of the bright lights that you'd seen in some of the states. What are some examples that you would hold up where it's working in states?
You'll see examples in, again, the Ohio's and the Wisconsin's, where community groups, and it's what Catherine's talking about, made up of consumers and family members and community leaders, have banded together for years with kind of a common vision. And the common vision is that the people with serious mental illness don't live in board and care homes, that they have access to supported employment programs, that they have access to inpatient beds when they need to, and that they battle to pass health insurance parity. When those coalitions get together in states, what you tend to find is a higher level of visibility and discussion about serious mental illness. The other kind of side piece, and it has to do with the issue of stigma, is the notion of putting a consumer face on mental illness in communities and having people understand that this is a very treatable illness and these are people in our communities. And so there are exemplary programs like our Inner Own Voice program, but other programs across the country that put a consumer face on the illness. And I think that's essential if we're ever going to have any movement away from some of the stigmatizing activities that we see today.
Well, I think that these are all important steps forward, and I think we are making progress. I think there are some big challenges at this point in history, which is that because of the way we now pay for mental health services, the center of gravity has shifted from the kind of state mental health agency to the Medicaid programs, to the corrections department, to the education system. And so it's a slightly different set of institutions that are really making the most critical decisions about what services get paid for, how they get delivered, where they get delivered. And I think the challenge for us, and particularly for people like Catherine, is to figure out what are the institutions that are going to be the stewards of the modern mental health system that sort of guarantees it, because the players are different, and it's harder to point your finger and say, you're the one who's in charge here, because the institutions have been shifting so importantly in the last few years.
And then also, how do you get those institutions to communicate?
Right. I think that is the most intriguing question and really the heart of transformation work. I think Richard really nailed it. I think that the reality is that the ironic point is that we don't ask the same question about the healthcare system in general. We ask that question about the mental health care system. So I would say contextually, it's very interesting from the standpoint of how do we try to identify the stewards in mental health care, and are there stewards generically in healthcare? So I think that's kind of an interesting question. The fact that you have 55 different mental health systems in America grew up, so 50 states and the territories grew up because mental health care was isolated from the other healthcare system, isolated for centuries. And so how do we now bring mental health care into the fold of general health care and primary care, but at the same time recognize that there are unique behavioral health care specialties in mental health and substance abuse that need to be addressed? So each state, interestingly, is grappling with that differently. And so you may have a state, as Michael indicated, that is going forward with very innovative public-private partnerships. They may want to change their mental health care system that's publicly funded and merge it with the public health system. There are other states who say, no, we want to keep a specialty behavioral health care system alive, but we want to integrate more completely on a local level with primary care. You have states doing very different things. And so you really do have to support states getting knowledgeable about organization and financing from other institutional perspectives. And that's the challenge. That's why it's so important to allow states and communities the time to step back, share their vision, and say, oh, Department of Education and oh, Department of Corrections and Criminal Justice, you have a stake in this. You have a stake in this because one in five individuals that live here may have a mental illness in their lifetime. And if they show up in your schools and they show up in your prisons, you have a stake in this. And just getting those players to the table and then reinforcing what recovery means and having them embrace a recovery vision and then apply that across the institutions is the challenging work of transformation.
It's consistency of vision over time, developing a political will, and having a community sort of reinforce that, because governors may be gone in 4 years, commissioners turn over with some frequency, and there really needs to be a base in the community of people who care deeply about mental illness and getting it right. That can sort of push that vision over time.
But there's got to be a way to learn. And what's actually really exciting is that some of the grants that Catherine has given out in this past year, for example, one is to the state of New Mexico, which is seeing an entirely different model of stewardship.
Right.
And it's creating a different kind of integration. And, you know, we don't know how it's going to work, but it's a vision and it's a really important attempt to grapple with the problems that we've just set out.
Now, one of the big issues is parity in terms of mental health care and general health care. Richard Frank, you just completed a study, co-authored a study a few months ago on this very issue. Can you talk a little bit about the study and the findings?
Sure. Our study was essentially an evaluation of the parity initiative that was put into place originally under President Clinton and continued under President Bush that required the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program, which is probably the largest private health insurance program in the nation, to treat mental illness and substance abuse services on par with all other kinds of health care. And for probably 35 years now, there's been a reluctance on the part of policymakers to adopt parity because of fear about cost control and runaway costs. And so this was the first evaluation of parity that was complete parity in the context of managed care. And what we found is that there was no significant increase in either total costs for the system, only very modest increases in total costs for the payer, the insurers, and that individuals, particularly individuals who were quite sick, got dramatic increases in the financial protection. So they carried less financial burden when they were hospitalized with psychosis, for example. And so really this showed that parity today fixes insurance in a way that is both economical but also consistent with offering people real financial protection against illness.
Michael Fitzpatrick, what is the state of parity in the different states? We talked a little bit earlier before we began the show about how many states have actually passed parity laws.
It's very much alive. 37 states have passed some variation of parity. Last year, 4 states, almost out of the blue, passed parity. It was exciting. The parity movement goes back to the early 90s, and there was originally a large rush of states that passed it early on. It's been slower since. But even in a couple large states that haven't passed parity, there are large coalitions in New York and Ohio that continue to work to try to push through parity. It's something that advocates and service providers and others understand. As Richard just said, it's very affordable. It has a significant human impact on the family. And frankly, helps you build the system and doesn't allow for the cost shifting that goes on. We believe that insurance companies do have responsibility for paying for mental illness the same way they do physical illness.
We totally support parity and continue to work very hard to ensure parity. And I think parity, even though it is handled both at the federal level and also at the state level through legislation, is also an undergirding for the continuing discussion that needs to go on from an advocacy standpoint about really what was the number one recommendation from the New Freedom Commission, and that was that mental health is essential to overall health. And if we can continue to raise that discussion through parity and through the parity studies, and I think, you know, Richard's work is just wonderful and a mm-hmm. terrific reinforcement of the belief that has been held in many quarters for a long, long period of time. And I hope, frankly, that his study settles some of the debate that has been going on, because I think we should move forward in a very positive way around parity.
Now, your study focused on private insurance. What about parity with Medicare? Are there still issues there?
Well, if I could say one more thing about
this. Oh, please
go ahead. Well, one is just it's very important to recognize that the reason that parity is affordable today, and there were doubts about it 10, 20 years ago, is because managed care is coupled with it. Mm-hmm. And so there must be a way to control costs. And what our new world offers is a set of organizations that can control the costs without putting the onus on the patient and on the consumer. And so that's what's really different. Now, turning to Medicare, Medicare is still, in many respects, a mental health benefit of the 70s. There's 50% cost sharing for psychotherapy. There are various exclusions for things that are evidence-based. So, for example, if you go to the clinical literature and you read about what is the best way to treat depression, it turns out that a lot of the things that are recommended can't exactly be paid for on the Medicare. The collaborative care model, for example, which is a very popular and effective treatment approach. And so it is that poses a real challenge to the health policy community.
We actually had an email kind of along the same vein. It was specific to Medicaid, but I think it applies to the overall theme mm-hmm. of the payment. This is, how will Medicaid focus on demonstrating medical necessity and the SAMHSA focus on empowerment recovery from a consumer perspective of self-benefit be reconciled when it comes to payment for services? Who will pay for what?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very important question, and one of the things that we are working on at SAMHSA and throughout DHHS, and particularly with our partners at the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, one of the things that we're doing as a part of transformation is we created a federal action agenda that is all the federal partners who are engaged in mental health care. And I think actually it's sort of the fourth significant report from the first three that you talked about, that there was this federal action agenda that federal partners came together and said, we really do need to start focusing in on mental health. That started the discussion and started the dialogue with our other partners at the Department of Health and Human Service, including the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And we have found that there is more discussion that needs to be had about that. While SAMHSA is supporting evidence-based practices and supporting more outcome-focused services, The medical necessity definition, which, by the way, is a definition that gets modified and looked at across every state, because we have to remember that Medicaid is a state plan, and so each state has a different kind of Medicaid plan that they've agreed to with the federal government. But that the medical necessity definition can sometimes be limiting, and therefore we need to kind of have further conversation about what is a service that is appropriate, that is evidence-based, that in fact promotes recovery, and that might not have been in the traditional menu of services that were paid for by any of the traditional payers. We see that absolutely across the federal government. We also, by the way, see that in private insurance companies. I mean, we're encouraging employers to look at their benefits and look at their insurance packages that they purchase, so that you're hopefully influencing both the federal payer as well as the private payer. So there is a lot of dialogue that needs to go on, and I would encourage the individuals who have some concern about that to specifically get in touch with us, and we'll make sure, because I think the notion of the consumer face that Michael raised is very important, that consumers need to demand the kinds of services that are appropriate and that are recovery focused, and then the payers will, I think, listen to that.
And because of because there are 50 or 55 different Medicaid programs in America, the critical thing is that you have enough flexibility in those Medicaid programs, because that's basically what funds the community system and drives it. The people can get a range of services, given that mental illness looks different and needs to be treated differently depending on sort of where someone's condition is. Because the financing is just absolutely crucial. And so what you have right now is experiments driven by the Deficit Reduction Act in a number of states that will look to bring the mental health system into the healthcare system. We'll look at changing the way we pay for services, what the services look like, what outcomes look like. It's a fascinating time, but it's also a dangerous time. So it requires us to be, I think, both vigilant, but also be at the table as these changes are taking place.
Now, you mentioned the Deficit Reduction Act. Is that something that you all are following? Because I know there are some concerns that some of the cutbacks that were passed in Medicaid will affect mental health care.
Well, I think there are actually pluses and minuses in the children's systems. There is actually some pilot programs that would certainly allow states to take on innovative programs that would stop overuse of residential treatment programs. Our concern is mainly over the use of premiums and copays. Given that the average SSI check is a little over $600, a studio apartment is about 95% of that, that if you're going to charge copays or premiums for individual services within our states, have the flexibility or the ability to do that. We're concerned that unless there's flexibility built in, that's going to be a disincentive for people to maintain services. So we're going to have to see how this plays out. This is, because you could have 50 different programs. And again, there are four or five experiments going on, and again, the Kentuckys and the West Virginias and Florida and Utah, that everyone's sort of watching very closely. And they're models that haven't really been tried before. The history of managed care in this country and behavioral health is not particularly a good one. It's been a rocky road, but again, we're all at the table, and we're gonna play this through and see where it takes us.
We also had a number of emails about people suffering from mental disorders who end up in prison, either because they don't have access to treatment, mm-hmm. or because they're not taking their medications. I'd open this really up to any of you. What can be, first of all, how common of a problem is this, and what can be done?
Well, you heard the history of the system, that 25 years ago, many of these people would have been in a state hospital. They never would have found themselves in the criminal justice system. So to some extent, lack of mental health courts, lack of treatment systems, an inability for many people with serious mental illness to find services that are accessible to them, all create a system where people end up before a judge and find themselves in prisons. And the services in prisons are, clearly not first rate. But what you need to do initially is to create a service system that allows people to get services when they need them, to have their families understand what they're seeing, so the general education in the community about what mental illness looks like, and that these services are readily available, emergency services that are available 24 hours a day, assertive treatment services, where people can get people coming to their apartment or their home to help them get the services that they need. A more assertive, a more outreach, a more interactive system than we have available in many states.
Over the last decade, I think we've all been grappling with what we termed the criminalization of mental illness and the criminalization of mentally ill individuals or individuals with mental illness. And it's a problem that continues to grow in many ways because the notion that people who have these serious illnesses may in fact become involved with the law is clearly out there. I mean, it's a fact of some of the existence in some cases of individuals with both mental illnesses and substance abuse problems. What we found very effective is an education process between the criminal justice system and the mental health system and the substance abuse system. So just an education process. They come from different cultures. They speak different languages. And the whole notion of being able to exchange information on individuals who are in the judiciary and who are in prisons and jails and who obviously encounter individuals with these serious disorders, understanding, again, what recovery is, understanding that people can, in fact, manage these illnesses and begin to think differently about these people will really, I think, help those individuals who do end up in the criminal justice system. Also, we found what is most effective is appropriate diversion programs, mm-hmm. mental health courts, substance mm-hmm. abuse courts, those jurisdictions that have become sensitive to the fact that simply by virtue of having a mental illness, you should not end up in jail, you should not end up in prison. And if you can divert people appropriately into programs that are counseling programs, medication management programs, and hopefully housing and supported work in programs, you are far less likely to have people get engaged in the criminal justice system. And those programs are very effective.
What you've seen all over the country is whatever state I go to, I find out that there are what's called CIT or community intervention training programs occurring for police. So police are being trained. Police, in many cases, are on the front lines. And so there's a heightened awareness of what mental illness is, how do you treat it, mm-hmm. What do you look for, how to bring in mental health professionals. And so in virtually every major city in this country, there's some level of training going on now.
And there's also the issue about when individuals are incarcerated. Incarceration itself can be a stressor. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as people leave prisons, and who will, in fact, in most cases, go back to the communities from which they came, what kind of transition planning is going on between the criminal justice authorities, the substance abuse and mental health authorities? Very, very important to have that connection and to make sure that as people are released from prison, they get more than bus fare and a day's worth of medication. That's that, right. In fact, there is a connection back to the system and to the people responsible for the community and local care. And we've seen some jurisdictions do exceptional work in this area, that they may or may not have had appropriate mental health services in prison. In some cases, they're doing very well, in others, they're not. But that if we don't make that connection, the chances of the recidivism cycle starting all over again is profound.
We also had a few emails about Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and the mental health issues there in terms of before the hurricane struck and then what was caused after they struck. Mm-hmm. So I know, Catherine Pryor, you just got back from a seminar on this or a meeting on this. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We were just had a great 3-day conference in New Orleans called the Spirit of Recovery, which was the first time ever that the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration sponsored teams from 54 jurisdictions, states and territories, to come together to talk about behavioral health in the wake of disasters. And I think it was the experience with Katrina and Rita and Wilma that really brought to bear the importance of mental health, not only mental health status of individuals who were affected by the storm. It brought to bear questions about what kind of mental health supports existed before the infrastructure was destroyed. It brought to bear what kinds of important supports do we need to have in a community during this rebuilding process. What kinds of supports from a mental health perspective need to be there as we, by the way, approach the first anniversary of Katrina. And then what do we need to be thinking about a year from now, 5 years from now, et cetera. And what did we learn from disasters like 9/11 about those kinds of things. So tremendous, tremendous, as awful as this disaster was, it is the first time that, from my perspective, I have seen people talking about mental health, as you do in your question, and why mental health is important in terms of disaster preparation and dealing with mental health issues. We, at SAMHSA, we sent down teams of mental health providers immediately and still have people there on the ground who are providing mental health supports, psychological first aid, doing a whole host of things in terms of just supporting people, listening to people, helping people. We also had a tremendous response in terms of staffing the suicide hotline, 1-800-273-TALK, and there was an enormous increase in the suicide hotline post-Katrina and continues to be at very high levels post-Katrina. And then we also, through our partnership with FEMA, have a very dynamic crisis counseling program. So each of the states affected by the disaster have applied for and received crisis counseling funds that go right into the hands of local providers and to the state agencies to provide counseling supports, to provide case management, to provide connecting services for them. And we're actually very heartened by the fact that this is now, frankly, an opportunity for these coastal states whose mental health systems may have been not as well developed as they wanted to actually now transform and rebuild their systems in a way that are much more community focused and that are much more responsive to not only the general mental health needs of people, but also take into consideration what is unique about being in this disaster area.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think in both Mississippi and Louisiana, their systems were inadequate before the disaster. And this is really an opportunity to sort of put them back together and have them be a better system. The other interesting thing is we were overwhelmed by the number of $25 and $50 checks from around the country that came in through our website that we were able to give send directly to our affiliates in Louisiana and Mississippi to help out with housing in particular. And it was just America really just responded.
Right?
It was just wonderful to see.
Just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think the rebuilding will take a long time. I mean, there is a Louisiana Recovery Authority that's responsible for rebuilding from both an infrastructure standpoint and from a physical structure standpoint. And we're so happy to see mental health front and center in those discussions.
They're representing, recommending 5,000 beds for supported housing. Unheard of.
It's wonderful.
It's tremendous.
I mean, it really is. And so,
So
that tells us that I think we've really reached that tipping point in America where people are now going to say, so what about the mental health aspects? What about the psychological makeup of the people who are there? What is the dimension? How is that being addressed? And how is that going to affect the population and their willingness to return to this area and rebuild it? The fact that people are asking those questions and saying, we want to make sure that we have systems of support and care that will take care of the stressors of living in this post-disaster area. We want to take care of the grief that is going to be felt. We want to take care of the losses that people feel. We want to take care of the healing. We want to do that. It's actually quite reassuring that these communities are facing the mental health demands and the mental health dimension of post-disaster response.
Well, you had talked about housing. We actually got a number of emails, just to broaden it beyond Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and Wilma. Can you talk a little bit about the problem of mental health issues and homelessness, and how big of a problem is it really?
Well, it's huge. I think if there's any lack of investment around the country, it really has been in supported housing, and that's housing that's accessible, affordable, safe, but comes with services built in that's permanent, that people can move in and move in for the rest of their lives if they choose to. But more importantly, that's affordable and available to people. And it's been a struggle. You know, many people with serious mental illness have Section 8 vouchers, but the waiting lists are still months and months, in some cases years long. And frankly, you're not going to return to your community and be able to recover from mental illness unless you have a place to live that really meets your needs and is really affordable. And so while there are model programs all over the country, there are best practices, there's been no consistent investment, which really requires a partnership on the local level between housing authorities with the federal government, with the state governments, to really put together a concerted plan to build enough, a sufficient number of beds that are accessible to people to allow them to be able to recover from mental illness, because the next step would be supported employment, to have activities during the day that make you feel good, make you be willing to take risks and return to your life.
I think the issue of homelessness is an important one in the sense that people become homeless for a variety of different reasons. And some of it is inability to pay, mm-hmm. the disappearance of the housing stock,
right.
not necessarily because they have a particular disorder, but by virtue of being homeless, the stressor of being homeless itself can bring on major stress, other stressors and other disorders. So for me, the issue is always being homeless itself is something that we want to eradicate. The fact that some people are homeless who are also mentally ill at the time is the issue, but it's not the larger issue. I think the government and certainly everyone in America wants to end homelessness. And I think that the kind of community coalitions that Michael's talking about are now happening. California, yeah. in Proposition 63, mm-hmm. has taken off a piece of that initiative and said, we are going to build appropriate housing sure. for individuals with mental illness who are also homeless. And that's wonderful. And so I'm hoping that, again, this improvement toward mental health care and this acceptance of individuals with mental illness will have an impact on other populations like individuals who are homeless, and it will be a synergistic effect that we can address both individuals who are homeless and those who have mental illnesses.
We actually had an email about this as well, and Richard, I'll direct this towards you. First, the President's New Freedom Mental Health Commission report calls for the creation of 150,000 units of permanent supportive housing for consumers and families who are chronically homeless. What do the experts recommend as a strategy for financing the mental health service component of the 150,000 units of supportive housing?
Well, I think, I think it's unfortunately, I don't see any way around it not being sort of at least a shared public-private responsibility. The basic problem is has already been well stated, which is that the biggest single driver is the cost of housing. People are priced out of the market, and people with severe and persistent mental disorders, whether they get income support aid or not, tend to be disproportionately represented among low-income groups. And so the combination of the nature and complexity of the illnesses, the nature of the housing market and the economic circumstances that these people find themselves in means that there has to be some financial assistance and financial support, and some kind of either local, federal, state, or presumably combination funding along with some private support, I think, is the only way that it will come together. The mix will vary from place to place, but I think that's the basic character of the answer.
It's a financing issue. 90% of people with serious mental illness in this country are unemployed. So what you're talking about is people who are on SSI or SSDI or not. And so what you need is some sort of as Rich is describing, is a partnership. And again, this change is going to happen at the community level, and for groups pulling together and understanding that if you do pull together, you can create systems that allow people to recover. And I think there are models out there.
Yeah, I mean, the evidence shows that, well-designed Section 8 supportive housing programs lead people to do better with their clinical services than they would if they weren't in that program, that their clinical services wind up being more effective because they're in this supported housing environment.
I just came back from a visit to Connecticut, which is one of the mental health grant states that received money for transformation. And we had a visit with a supported employment program and a supported housing program, mm-hmm. and that they've been very creative. And Connecticut has one of the highest per capita incomes and has one of the lowest per capita incomes right in a very short distance of each other in terms of their capital city. And so it's impressive and encouraging to see that despite the fact that people are priced out of the market and despite the fact that they have very serious illnesses, when you put your heads together, you actually can create wonderful incentive programs, as Richard indicated, at the local, state, and federal level, to say our business is to make sure that these individuals have a life in the community, have a roof that's safe and secure over their head, and are becoming meaningful, productive citizens through employment. That is no different than what everybody else wants, and it can be done.
And that innovation is why we gave Connecticut a B.
There it is.
Yeah, that you have states that have been able to put together those coalitions.
Right.
And they're really shining examples, I think.
And that goes back to your message of recovery then as well,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. That it's getting, it's grasping what that means, grasping the notion, and it really is a major sea change for mental health. I mean, for the centuries that Richard talked about, we put people in institutions, they needed to be taken care of. It's a very different movement to say they should be treated just as you and I are treated, and that we should be at the center of our healthcare planning. And that is a major sea change, and getting everyone to embrace that is really, I think, part of the work of transformation.
How much of a role does stigma play in people not embracing that?
I think stigma plays a tremendously large role. In a recent survey we did about what keeps people from getting care, because the majority of the people who have mental illnesses do not necessarily get care. So we know that as a fact from the Surgeon General's report. So that we asked people why they didn't get care, and the first was that they really felt that cost was a factor. They were unsure about the cost or insurance coverage for mental health if they had insurance. Secondarily, the other area was they were not quite sure that they needed services, which is also sometimes one of the factors with both mental illness and substance abuse. They weren't quite sure whether they needed services at that time. And the third most important factor was the stigma. Stigma meaning both the fear themselves about how they would be treated or how they would be perceived, or the anticipated embarrassment or shame if someone found out that they were going to seek mental health care. We have a long, long way to go about overcoming the stigma. And we found in all of these reports and in all of our work, we have found that the one most effective way to overcome stigma is to be engaged in a conversation and a relationship with someone with a mental illness.
Exactly.
That's the one thing, because once you know someone, or once you work with someone, or once you have someone in your family, or once you know someone with whom you can share stories and not just think about mental illness in this undefined, unpersonal way, it makes all the difference in the world for understanding and helping then create an environment in which people will not feel stigmatized.
So treating mental illness the same way you would a heart condition or a broken arm, many people with serious mental illness, current research shows, begin to show signs of that mental illness by the age of 14. Many of them are not diagnosed and treated for decades later. And that has much to do with the stigma of mental illness.
Mm-hmm. So. There's another question that we had, and this is about paying for treatment. He wants to know, what suggestions do you have for integrating healthcare systems in a way that financial incentives and risks are shared across all healthcare without restricting access to evidence-based mental health practices? Richard, if I could direct that to you.
Well, there are a variety of things that go on in our system that sort of keep people from getting evidence-based treatment in the places that they'd most prefer to get treatment. And so, perhaps if I could give you an example, in the way we treat depression, about half of people with depression get treated in primary care offices, and that's where they want to be treated. And they often have other medical disorders that get treated along with their depression, and so it's their preferred modality. And for years, we've had a lot of difficulty getting the expertise on mental health issues into the primary care settings. And I think one of the reasons is that some of our specialty institutions have been very separate from our general medical institutions. Our insurance arrangements have created fragmentation between those systems. And so I think what leads me to be somewhat optimistic here, and what I think we ought to be doing more, is trying to bring mental health expertise and the mental health system to the primary care setting in to a greater extent than we have. And that would be, for example, getting care managers who are very effective in guiding the treatment of depression with some mental health background to work with primary care practices. Even if they're not located there, they could be located at a managed care company or at a specialty clinic and still do the work in both places. And I think it's those kinds of measures that could be undertaken. And there are some programs right now underway that are doing that. In California, there's some experimentation with that in the private sector. The state of Colorado is doing it in their Medicaid program for people with medical comorbidities and depression. And the state of Massachusetts is doing it in their Medicaid program. So I think there's a serious effort being directed at that and trying to figure out organizationally and financially how to make it work.
Final question for all three of you, and then we'll wrap it up. Just using the National Alliance on Mental Illness's report card in 3 years kind of as the benchmark, can you just all say briefly where you hope we'll be in 3 years in terms of the grades that the United States will get in their mental health coverage and how realistic that would be?
Well, I hope that having started in this work about 2.5 years ago when I came to the Center for Mental Health Services and I was given the commission report and asked to read it and to move forward on it, I hope that in 3 years' time we can show evidence across America. And again, across America means not only sort of a national attitude and a national perception about mental illnesses and individuals with mental illnesses, but at a 50-state level, we can show evidence that everyone has done something that is transformative, that has adapted a recovery vision, that has is using evidence-based practices in their work, is developing a workforce that is culturally sensitive, that is focused on quality care, that has an accountable method of showing how resources are used to improve care, and that shows evidence that communities own the mental health of their community. And I think that we're going to be able to say in 3 years that that has happened, because I believe we are at the tipping point, clearly today at the tipping point, where that will now begin to happen across America. I see evidence of it already in many states. I think many states will have difficulty bringing it to scale. They may have pockets of excellence. Now they have to bring it to scale. And I hope that America will stand as a beacon for the way in which individuals with mental illnesses should be treated.
The challenge, as Catherine said, is to create it at scale, so it becomes so services are available across states, across regions, and really reflect the values of the New Freedom Commission report and certainly our grading report. I like the response of the commissioner of Kentucky the day after the report when we gave Kentucky an F. He said, "Next time I want a B." And that's the response we saw really around the country, kind of a let's get to it.
Yeah.
We understand there are holes in our systems. We understand what works. We understand what the best practices are. So let's pull together and next time everyone gets a B. And that's what we all need to work for.
And Richard Frank?
Well, to me, the things that have driven the improvement that we've seen are the fact that mental health, to a larger extent than it ever in history, has become part of the mainstream. It's in the mainstream of financing programs, it's the mainstream of insurance, and while we need, as Catherine put it, specialized sensibilities to the unique challenges of mental health, I think that's been a driver. And so what I'd like to see as part of the transformation is our main institutions, Medicaid, Medicare, welfare, education, all develop the mental health sensibilities that they need to continue to drive those financing streams to support the kinds of initiatives on the ground that we've discussed here today. But I think that we really need this new stewardship at the top, sort of steering the ship in a slightly different way than we have.
Thank you all so much for joining us. Catherine Power, Michael Fitzpatrick, and Richard Frank, we really appreciate y'all being here with us today. And thanks to all of you for tuning in and, of course, for your questions. I'm Jill Braden-Balderas with KaiserNetwork.org.